So this is the final lecture in financial management. The topic today is exchange rate risk management, and we're going to be building on what hopefully we've learned in the past two lectures when I introduced to you the world of exchange rates and currencies. So the key theme today is risk management. And if you were to look back to the notes for the very first lecture, towards the end of those lecture notes, I listed the five key themes of financial management, and theme number five is risk management. Now, there's a lot more for you still to learn, obviously, about risk management next year and indeed in your final year. This is my attempt to introduce you to the world of risk management. In this context, we're looking at exchange rate risk management. So that means managing the risk inherent in the fact that exchange rates can change. Risk is exposure to change. And what's changing here is the exchange rate between two particular currencies. Don't always think of risk as necessarily a bad thing. Investment banks make a lot of money by trading on risk. However, my focus today, the context for this lecture, is a company, a large company, with overseas exposure. So what I'm thinking of is a company that has some overseas subsidiary where it is producing and selling the goods or services that it's in the business of delivering, and or possibly it has suppliers of raw materials or indeed services overseas. So keep reminding yourself that typically what we have in mind is a UK company, because after all we're based in the UK, a UK company with exposure to some exchange rate, maybe a whole set of different exchange rates, e.g. between pound sterling and the euro, or pound sterling and the US dollar, or whatever. And the reasons it might have that exposure are, one, it's got a subsidiary in an overseas country, maybe France or Germany, or possibly in the States, and that subsidiary is making some particular product or providing some sort of service for which it bills its customers in the foreign currency. So its subsidiary that's operating in France is making something that it sells in France and which it charges in euros for. But at the end of the day, the company, the parent company, is concerned about the revenue expressed in sterling terms. So it has to convert. It has to repatriate that revenue back into the UK. So what matters at the end of the day is, how much money is it making in sterling terms? And it's that that exposes it to the vagaries, the possibility of changes up and down in the exchange rate, say, between sterling and the euros. Likewise, if it has a supplier in a foreign country, that supplier will bill the parent company, our company, it will bill our company in that foreign currency. But again, at the end of the day, what the company is concerned about is ultimately, when all is said and done, how does it look in sterling terms? So clearly, a company with some form of overseas operations is exposed to exchange rate risk. And companies in that position aren't going to sit on their hands and just take their chances. They want to manage that exchange rate risk. And what we want to look at in this lecture then, in broad terms, are ways in which it can do that. Now, I've got to get the standard stuff out of the way first. And one of the reasons I've got to get the standard stuff out of the way is so that we can look at professional accountancy bodies and say with a clear conscience, yes, we do cover topics like transaction risk, translation risk, and economic risk. We don't do a lot on it, but we do mention it. The students do meet those ideas in the first term module, financial management. So the first few slides are in the pack for that purpose. So let's just be clear about what each of these three terms means. Let me motivate it for you as best I can. I could ask you as part of an exam question, define the following terms: transaction risk, translation risk, economic risk. So you want to be able to say something about what is summarised on these slides. Let's start then with transaction risk. So what is that? Well, typically transaction risk arises because the company buys or sells some goods or services, but it doesn't pay for those goods or services today. It pays or collects the revenue from delivering those goods or services at some point in the future. Therefore, it's exposed to the risk that the exchange rate can move against it. During the period of time that elapses between today, when it strikes the deal with its trading partner, and when it comes to settling up. So that's what I mean by transaction risk. There's a transaction involved. The company is either selling some products or goods, or indeed buying those products or goods, but payment for the goods or services isn't today, it's at some point in the future. That's broadly what I mean by transaction risk. And it really matters because it really involves cash flows. Unlike translation risk, which we'll go on and talk about in a minute, which is an accounting term, transaction risk is real. The size of the cash flows involved when it comes to paying up change. They are impacted by changes in the exchange rate. So let's look at this very simple example of a UK firm that locks into a trading agreement to buy $45 million US dollars of goods from a company based in the States. Now, as far as that company in the States is concerned, the bill is £45 million. Whatever happens tomorrow, make sure that doesn't happen. Okay? Because if someone from the exams office is present and that happens, that's a memo to me and the dean, and I'm in trouble. So make sure that phone doesn't go off tomorrow. So, as far as the supplier, the US supplier is concerned, the cost is $45 million. But payment isn't now. Payment, let's keep things simple, payment is in 1 year's time. Very generous terms, so it's an artificial example. The cost is going to be $45 million 1 year from today. But what our UK company cares about is, how much sterling is that going to be? If the deal had been settled today, let's say the exchange rate's not that far from where it is today, in fact, if £1 could be exchanged for $1.50, then in sterling terms, the bill would be £30 million. But the bill, the supplier's bill, is not settled today, it's settled a year from today. And what matters is, what will the exchange rate between the pound sterling and the US dollar be in 1 year's time? Suppose the US dollar appreciates against the pound. Now, what does that mean? That means that a pound buys fewer dollars. Each pound buys fewer dollars. That's bad news for this UK company. It's going to cost it more pounds in order to settle its outstanding bill of $45 million. A year from now, if the exchange rate has changed to $1.25 per pound, this company is going to have to pay the sterling equivalent of £36 million. That's quite an uplift in its liability. So this is a concern. This company is bound to be concerned about the possibility that the US dollar could strengthen or appreciate against the pound in the intervening year, because the upshot of that will be it will cost the company more in sterling terms to pay this particular bill. That's transaction risk. Of course, the exchange rate could move in the other direction, and the company will end up paying less than £30 million in sterling terms. But that's not what's keeping the senior managers of the company awake at night. They're worried about this scenario where the dollar appreciates, not depreciates, where it appreciates against sterling. So that's transaction risk. It's linked directly to transactions. It involves actual cash flows. But the point is, the flow of cash is occurring at some point in the future, not today, and therefore we have to worry about what will the exchange rate be at that point in the future when the bills come in and have to be settled. Translation risk is something quite different. Translation risk is an accounting phenomenon. Now, it's no less important for that, but it's not something that we will have much to say about, as you might expect in this module, but you should be aware of it. And translation risk typically comes to the fore when what you're looking at is a group of companies. So there's some parent company, there's headquarters set up with a number of overseas subsidiaries. At the end of the accounting year, that parent company, that group of companies, has to produce what's called a consolidated set of accounts. And that's where the translation risk comes in. Because when it comes to producing that set of consolidated accounts, they have to use the relevant exchange rates that apply on that day of consolidation. So it's not the exchange rate on the day that the different transactions or cash flows take place, it's the day on which the company as a whole produces its consolidated accounts. Now, if you like, this is a paper phenomenon. Unlike transaction risk, it's not impacting the size of actual cash flows, but it's no less important for that, because at the end of the day, the company has to produce a set of accounts that some auditor will approve, and the numbers that are in those consolidated accounts do have an impact on the financial management of the story, because there may very well be what are called restrictive covenants that apply to the debt that's in the company's capital structure. Now, what do I mean by that? A restrictive covenant is a condition that the lenders have applied to the loan they've given the company. The lender may insist that the money isn't used for particular activities. More likely, the lender will insist on the liabilities of the company not going above a certain level. At the end of the day, what matters are the values of the assets and the liabilities in sterling terms. Ours is a UK company, after all, headquartered in the UK. If when the company comes to produce its consolidated accounts and it uses the various exchange rates, at that point in time, it's possible that the total amount of liabilities on the books, expressed in sterling terms, breaches some limit agreed with the lenders. And that's a problem. That's a problem for the company in terms of keeping some of its lenders happy. It's certainly a problem for the company in terms of its chances of borrowing any more money. So although it's a paper issue, it has to do with the financial reporting of the group of companies, it does have implications for the financial management. And I just want you to be aware of that. The final one, economic risk, is the hardest of the three to model and manage because it's so general. So economic risk is looking at the company as a whole, but it's standing back and looking at the company against the broader canvas of the sector of the economy in which it operates, and standing further back to look at the economy as a whole, and it's attempting to do this out into the future, out into the long-term future. So the key technique that's involved in modelling, I hesitate to say managing economic risk, because I'm not sure I believe any company can manage economic risk. That's a moot point. But the key concept here is one of scenario planning for the long term. So companies that engage in modelling and attempting to manage economic risk, and the examples that come to my mind are the big oil companies. Shell has a well-established reputation for doing this sort of thing, and indeed it's shared some of that know-how with various business schools. They're not the only company to do so. The DuPont Chemical Company is also well known for this. But the idea is that people in the company sit down together and think about possible scenarios for the company, and indeed the economy more generally, out into the long-term future. Where the company has overseas activities or overseas suppliers, in other words, wherever there's exposure to exchange rate variations, they're attempting to model that over the long run. And if you can remember back from last Wednesday's lecture, you should be thinking, they must make use of purchasing power parity. Because purchasing power parity, we believe, works best, finds its feet, in terms of long-term forecasting of exchange rates. So what we learned last week in PPP, it really comes into its own in this context. Okay, so those are the general concepts. That's it. We can keep the professional accountancy bodies happy in terms of their accreditation. The rest of this lecture then is going to talk about hedging. Now this is a word that I've mentioned from time to time without really putting much flesh on the bones. Again, there's only so much I can tell you in the space of half a lecture. You'll go on and do a lot on hedging in second and third year, particularly in the module Finance 1 next year, and if you choose to take it, the module Derivatives and Financial Risk Management in final year. We'll also do hedging in the context of exchange rates in the final year module International Financial Management, and indeed you'll study hedging in some detail in the context of fund management in the final year module Investment Management. So this is just a taster. This is just to introduce to you the idea of hedging as a tool, a device for managing exposure to risk. And I want to draw a distinction between internal, no yawns please, this isn't the most exciting part of the whole story I've tried to tell you this term, internal hedging and, don't get too excited on the other hand, external hedging, which involves cleverer techniques. So let's get the internal hedging out of the way quickly. I don't have much more to say than is actually written on the slide. I'll try and expand very briefly, and then we can get into the more interesting stuff, the external hedging techniques. So I list here for you some broad brush headings of different internal hedging techniques. And I want you to understand that internal hedging means doing things with the cash flows of the company, linked with its suppliers and its customers, but not making any use of clever techniques that involve financial contracts like forwards and futures, options, swaps. We're not going anywhere near the derivatives markets in this slide. When we go on to the next slide, then we're going to put a toe, just a toe though, into the world of derivatives. So what's the first idea? The first idea is called netting, netting out. And the idea is that the company stands back and looks at the complete package, the complete picture of cash flows. So think of head office, think of headquarters as in the centre of a diagram. We can just do this in our minds. So there's headquarters, and there at various points of the diagram are subsidiaries. So the whole picture has headquarters, corporate centre in the middle, together with any number of subsidiaries. Now join up these individual satellites or subsidiaries with the main planet, the headquarters, and think about the cash flows that are going in either direction between each of the subsidiaries and the headquarters. So cash flow that is supplied by headquarters to enable the subsidiaries to do whatever it is they need to do. So that might be injection of funds into some budget, could be an R&D budget, whatever. And the cash flows that each of the subsidiaries return to the headquarters, job done. In netting, we don't focus on the individual cash flows between any one subsidiary and the headquarters. We stand back and we look at the whole picture. So if the direction of cash flow between one subsidiary and headquarters is outwards in the direction of the subsidiary, if the direction of cash flow between another subsidiary and the headquarters is in towards the centre, we net out the difference. Now why are we doing this? Because ultimately what matters is the net cash flow for the group as a whole and its exposure to different exchange rates. So we might be, changes in a particular exchange rate, say between sterling and the euro, might affect one cash flow between one subsidiary and headquarters in one direction, but if the cash flow is going in the opposite direction and it's involving the same currencies, if the cash flow is going in the opposite direction between another subsidiary and the headquarters, the two effects are clearly offsetting. And all we need to worry about is the net cash flow. And we have to do that for each currency pair therefore each exchange rate that the group of companies is exposed to. That's netting. Netting only involves the head office, the corporate centre, and the subsidiaries that all belong to the one company. Matching is a more general technique that also brings in suppliers and customers. So we take a further step back and we look to see at the direction of cash flow between suppliers and ourselves, and the direction of cash flow between ourselves and our customers. And again, we can think about netting out. Now, if you're thinking, I don't get this. This now just sounds artificial. Where does the management in all of this come? The management comes in the negotiation of the sizes, the amounts of cash that are to be paid in either direction, and the timings. That's where the management is coming into the story. And what's informing that management or negotiation with suppliers and customers, what's informing that those negotiations are what the company believes the different exchange rates might do. What direction might they change in? How can they influence the amounts of cash flow and the timing of those cash flows between suppliers and themselves and between customers and themselves? What scope is there for negotiation to alter how much is paid in either direction and when, in order to take advantage or minimise the negative impact of a possible change in the exchange rate? That's matching. It's more general than netting because it involves third parties who are typically suppliers or customers. Leading and lagging is pretty much the same idea. Suppose you're a UK company and you've sold some product or services to a customer in France. You're going to bill that customer in euros. I almost said French francs. You're going to bill that customer in euros, but at the end of the day, what you care about is the sterling equivalent of those euros. What if your view is, I'm going to bill this customer in euros, and having done a little bit of modelling, I think the euro is going to depreciate against sterling. So when it comes to convert the euros I receive from the customer, I'm not going to get as much sterling as I would hope. Wouldn't life be so much better for us if I could get the customer to pay up sooner whilst euros are relatively strong against sterling? How can you motivate the customer to pay up sooner? Answer, you offer them a discount. So that's an example of how you can negotiate with your customer. You can influence the behaviour of the customer to help insulate you against an adverse change in the exchange rate. And that would be an example of leading. You're bringing the payment forward in time. If you thought the opposite was going to happen, you might want to lag the payment, delay the payment. So you're governed by your own beliefs, your own views about the direction in which the relevant exchange rate is going to change. You're led by those beliefs, either to encourage earlier payment or to slow down payment. Now, more likely, the slowing down of payments will be your slowing down your payments to your suppliers. But hopefully you get the general idea. So those are examples of internal hedging. Now we can get to the more interesting stuff, which is external hedging. And this really is my attempt in the last half hour or so of this module to introduce you to the derivatives markets, get you thinking about it. The first example is known as money market cover. It's interesting because the way in which it works involves interest rates, but if you remember from last week's lectures, the currency markets and the bond markets are intimately related. We came upon several results, e.g. interest rate parity, that linked exchange rates with different interest rates. And this first technique makes use of that. This first technique, called money market cover, relies on the interest rate parity theorem to work. Now again, if you can think back to last week, I hope you remember that interest rate parity is believed to hold in the short term. So this sort of technique is going to be applied over the short term. And in finance, the short term means no more than 1 year. If we go beyond that 1 year threshold, then we're looking at the medium to longer term. So let's look at the little scenario that I've sketched out in this example. So we have a firm that exports some products or goods. Okay. It expects to receive at some point in the future, let's say 1 year, that's not realistic, is it? I mean, much more likely it's expecting to receive in a matter of months, typically 2 months, maybe 3 months, maybe as soon as 1 month. The reason why I don't want to pick that as my example is it just messes up the discounting in the little calculation I'm going to sketch out. So to keep the math as simple as possible, let's assume the artificial situation where this exporting firm is expecting to be paid for the goods or services that it's provided at 1 year in the future. What's it worried about? It's worried about an unfavourable change in the exchange rate during that time. All right. So, let's say then that it's a UK firm. Okay. It's a UK firm and it's expecting to receive a payment in US dollars 1 year from today. It's worried that the US dollar pound exchange rate is going to change against it. Remember, it's expecting to receive US dollars. Okay. So what's it going to do? It's going to borrow US dollars. It's going to borrow US dollars today. Let's do that. So it's going to borrow a certain amount of dollars today. And what's it going to do? It's going to exchange those dollars immediately into pounds at the going exchange rate, which will be S for spot, so many dollars per pound. And what's it going to do with the pounds that it's got? It's going to invest them in a UK bank account. Does that look familiar to you? Because what I'm hoping is, without putting in the numbers, let's not get bogged down, what I'm hoping is you recognise the elements of three of the four sides of the box that I drew for the interest rate parity theorem. We've got two transactions involving interest rates. So that's this one. I'm borrowing, say, in dollars, and I'm lending in pounds. I'm borrowing dollars for a year. I'm lending pounds for a year, coupled with a spot exchange rate today. And what the interest rate parity theorem says to us is that particular combination of three different trades is equivalent to a forward exchange rate. That is the same as a forward exchange rate. And if I can remind you, interest rate parity theorem, linking the forward exchange rate with the spot exchange rate and the nominal interest rates in the two countries. So what the money market cover strategy does is effectively create a forward exchange rate. It's known as a synthetic forward. We're actually, if you like, dealing in the money markets because we're borrowing, if you like, at a riskless rate in US dollars, and we're lending at a riskless rate in pound sterling. We're also doing a currency transaction today that has no uncertainty about it, because that spot exchange rate is known. So each of the three legs of this transaction, we know the variables, we know the values involved, and that sequence of all three is equivalent to locking in a forward exchange rate. And that's exactly what we want to do to hedge against currency variations. So money market cover works as long as the interest rate parity theorem holds. The interest rate parity theorem only works well in the short term. So this is a means of hedging against short-term variations in exchange rates. We're actually creating what's known as a synthetic forward exchange rate. We're not, in fact, entering into any agreement with a counterparty to take a forward position in a particular currency. We're effectively doing that by doing something with borrowing and lending together with an exchange of the two currencies today. So that's the money market cover. And that's the first hint that derivatives are involved here. That there are no derivative contracts in this example. It's a synthetic forward. It has the effect of a forward exchange rate. But when we go on to the next bullet points, now we really are in the world of derivatives. And that's what I want to spend the rest of the time talking about. So, if this exporting firm then, this is a UK company that's selling some product or services in the US for which it's paid in US dollars, but it then has to convert those dollars back into sterling, so it's worried about the pound dollar, or how many dollars per pound exchange rate changing against it. One thing that it can do is lock in that forward exchange rate explicitly. This is implicit. The money market cover strategy involves an implicit forward exchange rate, a synthetic forward exchange rate. But it's possible to do that directly. That involves the currency forwards. Now that's a market, but it's these currency forwards, these are not contracts that are traded on an organised exchange. These are contracts that are agreed between ourselves and one counterparty. Now those contracts are mediated, if you like, negotiated by a broker who stands in the middle. That broker typically represents a bank. But the forward contract is an agreement between ourselves and one other party. And it's tailored to fit our needs. So this is a highly bespoke contract. The broker charges a fee for making the deal come through, and part of what the broker is doing is finding a counterparty willing to take the other side of the transaction. Because it's a highly customised, highly bespoke contract, the broker's got to do some work in finding someone who will take the opposite side to the trade. That highly customised nature makes this contract relatively difficult to get in and out of. So trading of forwards contracts is not particularly liquid. We refer to them as examples of OTC, short for over-the-counter contracts. You won't find any of these contracts trading on an organised exchange. If you look at an organised exchange, and here we're in the world of derivatives, here we're thinking about locking in exchange rates into the future, so the relevant organised exchange, the relevant market, would be a currency futures market, of which far and away the largest example is the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. If you were to visit the Chicago Mercantile Exchange to learn something about the currency futures that are traded every day on the Merc, as it's known, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, you would quickly discover these futures contracts are standardised. Their features have been decided by the exchange, and it's very much a take it or leave it. That's off the shelf or off the peg tailoring, as distinct from bespoke tailoring, the forwards contract that is shaped and designed to meet your particular needs. But that makes it harder to find a counterparty who will agree to take the other side, and it makes it harder to get out of that contract, because you've basically got to find someone else who will take an equal and opposite position in a new contract in order to cancel the first one. So forward contracts are less liquid Nonetheless, they offer the sort of protection that you might want. Can anything go wrong with a currency forward? Well, there are basically two things that can go wrong. There's something called counterparty risk, and there's something called settlement risk. So basically, something can go wrong with the other party living up to their side of the trade. Something could go wrong with the buying or selling and paying for the goods or services. So something could go wrong at the level of the organisation that you're doing your trading with, by which I mean buying or selling your goods or services, and something could go wrong with the counterparty that takes the other side of this currency forwards contract. Provided neither of them happens, then you should be insulated against unfavourable changes in exchange rates. There are more sophisticated derivatives that you can make use of, but that really is the business of Finance One to tell you. The forward, the currency forward, is, I think, the simplest example that I can introduce you to. So, let's look at an example with numbers. You might not be surprised to learn that there is a diagram or two involved in this example. I think that helps. Okay. So what are we looking at here? We're looking at a company, the parent of which, so the headquarters, is based in the US. Let's just do it that way around for a change. But this US firm has a UK subsidiary, so it has overseas operations here in the UK. And this UK subsidiary is expecting to generate £1 million in sales revenue. Now, when I made the slide up, it was February, late February, and 3 months into the future was May. You might want to change that now to June, since now we're in March, in case that confuses you. The idea I had in mind was that in three months' time, the UK subsidiary expected to receive the revenue from selling the various products or goods, the various goods or services that it provides. So you might want to make that June. I'm using actual market rates from that point in late February. It was the 24th of February, if I recall. So the dollar-pound exchange rate, the spot exchange rate that day, was $1.5449. So that £1 million that was expected in receivables, that £1 million translates as $1,544,900. So if the dollar-pound exchange rate didn't change, if we were to switch off all the fluctuations that occur in the currency markets, and incidentally, the currency markets exhibit the greatest level of volatility of all of the markets, so that's a really silly thing to say or to imagine, but were the exchange rate not to change, then that would be the dollar amount that the parent company would ultimately receive. That's what would be remitted in dollars back to headquarters. Now let's look at this diagram then. So along the horizontal axis is the dollar sterling exchange rate. How many dollars for each pound? And this point on the horizontal axis denotes the current spot exchange rate of $1.5449. So at that spot exchange rate, £1 million translates as $1,540,900. Do you see the problem? The problem is, what if the US dollar appreciates? I.e., you get fewer dollars for each pound. Remember, the revenue is coming in initially in the form of pounds, sterling, and has to be converted into US dollars. If the dollar appreciates against sterling, each pound of revenue will buy fewer dollars. And at the end of the day, the total dollar revenue will suffer. That's what the headquarters are worried about. Oh, sure, if the exchange rate goes the other way, they end up with more dollars. But that's not what's troubling them. They'd be quite happy if they could just have $1,544,900. What they're worried about is this possibility. So let me just reconstruct that little diagram. So let's get the axis down here. So that's dollars per pound. Okay. And up here I have the following. So the current spot rate, 1.5449 dollars per pound. That's the spot rate. And that translates in terms of a revenue of, what did I say, 1,544,900 US dollars. Okay. And what we're worried about are exchange rate variations, and in particular the downside risk. You can see why it's called downside. The downside risk that the dollar sterling exchange rate will move to the left, that each pound will buy fewer dollars. What can we do about it? Well, we can look at the forward exchange rate and see if we can lock ourselves into a currency forward contract. On the same day, the 3-month forward rate was $1.5439. What if we could lock into that rate? At least then there would be no uncertainty. How can we do that? Well, let me first of all position that. So that would be hearsay. What did I say? $1.5439. Okay, let me just produce that line a bit further. And let me just put that marker there. So that would result in, sure, it would be a lower dollar revenue, but at least it would be a certain dollar revenue. It would be known for sure. And the company might be happy to settle for that and the peace of mind that comes with it. How can we do that? Answer, we can lock into a currency forward, for which the picture is this. We can lock in the currency forward rate as follows. We are receiving pounds sterling from our sales. We want to convert those pounds into dollars. We'd really like to lock in the rate at which we do that. So we can lock ourselves in to sell pounds forward. We can lock in the rate at which we exchange the pounds we'll receive from operations for dollars. That's selling pounds for dollars. Because we're locking in that at a forward rate, we refer to that as selling forward. So in the jargon, this refers to long the spot rate. I hope you can see why. And this refers to short for selling the forward. The company has this exposure to the spot exchange rate changing between now and 3 months from now. It can hedge against that exposure by simultaneously selling pounds forward for dollars. It can take a short forward position. The upshot of that is that the net position is level. What you should do is ask yourself, regardless of where the exchange rate ends up 3 months from now, so it could end up way up here, it could end up in this region, it could end up down here. Regardless of what the exchange rate does, the combination of the existing exposure to the spot exchange rate together with this short forward position we've taken, the net exposure is fixed. That's us locking in an exchange rate that won't change. So we've hedged ourselves against unfavorable changes in the exchange rate by taking a short currency forward position. It works. We have to pay for it. We have to pay for the broker who brings the counterparty into touch with us and sets it up. Can you see what the drawback is? The drawback is the following. It's all well and good if the spot exchange rate heads south. The currency forward, the short forward position, does its job. It keeps our net position level. The problem is, if the spot exchange rate heads northwards, if it moves to the right, because actually then we would like to switch off the hedge and enjoy the additional dollar revenue, but we can't. And that's the drawback of this currency forward. It does what it says on the tin. It hedges you against variations in the exchange rate. It doesn't pay attention to whether those variations are favourable or unfavourable. We can't switch it off unless we also do something else. And that's the limitation of the forward contract, and indeed, that's the limitation of the futures contract. How can we get around that? Answer, we have to take the next step into the world of the derivatives markets and take positions in options contracts. Because options contracts provide additional flexibility, we have to decide whether to exercise the option or not. We exercise it when we need it to work, and we don't bother to exercise it when we don't need it to work. But that's another story for which you have to wait until Finance One.